This episode of The A-Team is brought to you by FaceToFaceGames.com, Canada's number one source for Magic the Gathering card singles.
That, for some reason, pushed me to say, you know what, I'm going to come back and destroy him. And that's what happened. Or he stopped playing, but like if he did play, I would destroy him.
So it's what you're saying is that at every event now, it's okay for people to bring their horseshoe crabs up to you for signature?
Hope not.
Welcome to the A-Team Podcast, brought to your ears by ManaDeprived.com, home of Canadian Magic.
In 2010, a crack Magic playing unit was sent to prison by the DCI court for crimes they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a federal pound-me-in-the-ass prison to the Canadian underground. Today, still wanted by Wizards of the Coast, they survive as podcasters of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can listen to The A-Team.
KYT.
Anything that costs a shit ton of mana, you're just like, bang! And you're like, fuck.
How does that go?
Bang! Fuck.
Jay Boosh.
And that's like the hyper angle. I never want to play in another GP again. I never want to play in another GP.
And Jeremy.
And you're the reason I play Magic today. I'm like, I die. I was like just melting on the inside like that. I have inspired this kid to play Magic.
And now, the A-Team.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 259 of the A-Team Podcast. This is KYT. Once again, with my new best buddy, Matthew Mendoza. How's it going, buddy?
Good. How's it going?
Wow, I'm loving it. I think the fans have to appreciate you always put that extra effort. And Jeremy, again, his schedule is out of whack. And Jay is, about to wrap up school.
Awesome.
That's awesome, but sad for him. By the time he wants to come back, I actually want to say that to our A-Team fans, we're going to be taking a 3-week break for the holidays. I've been doing a lot of episodes. I can't count on one hand the numbers of episodes I've actually missed. And with Jay and Jeremy out of action, I really needed Matt to come through, and he has. Thank God he has come through. And people like TSG has mentioned that, you know, it's great that the recent episodes have forced me personally to talk more and contribute more, though I never considered myself a fan favorite of the A-Team, but those are kind words. So we're going to take a 3-week breather, and then we're going to reevaluate. Hopefully, Jay is still good with his time, and Jeremy says his schedule might change back to his normal schedule. So in the new year, we're looking at possibly a full crew.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. Once again, I want to mention to support the show, not only the show, but the website, go to patreon.com/KYTmagic. I've had some people donate $1 based on me talking about it last show. So that's awesome. Anything helps to pay for all the hosting costs for not only the podcast network, but the whole website itself and all the videos and everything. So huge thanks once again.
Yes.
And moving on to the show.
I have to emphasize donating. Please donate. Support the things that you love. I've been talking to KYT, and there's some conversations we have yet to have. There are a lot of cool things. I have a lot of cool ideas. I'm an idea man. And a lot of these ideas, like the giveaways and stuff. I like the giveaways. Magic has given a lot to me, and so I feel it only right to give back. So, but I want to do some more stuff like that. And making stuff costs money. Whether it's time that you're spent away from a job where you could be making money, or actually spending money on hosting and things like that. So, but yeah, please donate. And we appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, though I work for FaceToFaceGames.com now, all the time that I spent on the A-Team is not part of the job. So just so people don't get confused and everything, a lot of the mana-deprived stuff is very separate or is extra stuff that I do. So Back to starting the show, the actual show. What happened this past weekend was the WMC, the World Magic Cup, which I didn't personally catch too much of because, the coverage starts on Friday and I work Friday. And
I'm really surprised that you don't just have it on at work. Like,
yeah,
you work for Facebook.
I know, but it's distracting. I mean, some people have it.
Yeah,
like people have it on because they're like sorting cards and it doesn't ruin their rhythm. I'm trying to, like, let's say edit an article or edit, set up the GP site. So I can't like start watching because I'm just gonna, zone out focus on the World Magic Cup. Besides that, it's hard. I don't really care about the World Magic Cup when the other countries are in the feature match because they also deal with formats like unified standards that we don't really care about in terms of, us. Like, we can't base our next standard tournament based on some of these decks because of the restrictions that they have. Mm-hmm. And basically both Canada and US shat the bed. So when it came to the weekend where I have more free time to watch, we're not, I'm not excited because Canada is no longer there. And Mike Sigrist, who represents Face-to-Face Games, was no longer there. So it was a disappointing tournament for the North American teams who were, on the top five list of many people. But as I mentioned, we don't know. Team chemistry is a thing.
Uh-huh.
And the match that I did watch from the World Magic Cup was just so happened to be when I had a bit of free time on Friday at work to watch was Justin Richardson from Team Canada was on, but he had a Tarka Red and he was against a Rally deck and what was said on coverage to be a poor matchup. And he proceeded to flood in perhaps, I think, both of his games. Though the Rally deck was also flooding, like he was drawing, bricking, like visionaries and not getting, but Justin would have to, like, let's say, because every card he draws sort of gives him an incremental advantage, but all the other guy has to do was like rip a Rally, right, or rip a Collected Company, and that's like a huge explosive spell. So eventually Justin may have ripped a few threats off the top, but one Rally and it's like, oh, it's all but over. So it's a sad outing because, and now all the haters are coming out because since the new World Magic Cup format, Canada has never done well. Despite having stars on their team, whether it be Sean McLaren, and I think Alex Hain may have been on every edition of the team except for 1 year where John Stern actually usurped him as captain. But for the most part, Canada has done really poorly, and obviously a lot of the people on the outside are wondering why and are questioning it. And it's not like in sealed GPs where you see a lot of stars, like a star-studded team, they win. They win, if not all of them, or top four, all of them. And here we're not seeing that where, the top teams, like Canada, makes it up there. So
what did you hear?
For me, I think that there were some, I don't think they were super well prepared is what I've heard. I don't want to speak for them. But when you have to, not knowing too well, like the fourth player, on the team, I just happen to know Justin cause he's one of my friends and he actually works at Face-to-Face Games and I know he's a solid player, but when you have like, you have to pick for Constructed and for Sealed, you have to pick like three people to play that, and then you have to play three of the team members to play the other thing. And it's a challenge. What if, like, obviously Sean and Alex are probably pretty good, right, in either format, but what happens if the last two guys, and you have to play, like, all four players have to play at least something, right, during day one. It would make sense for them to enforce that rule. But what happens if, like, both of them are Constructed specialists, right? Mm-hmm. What happens if both of them are Limited specialists? Then you sort of have, like, a weak wheel on the team in either format. And there were considerations of maybe having Alex actually not play and instead coach the two weaker players while Sean played his game. So they didn't go with that strategy, which I find interesting.
That would have been interesting,
right? But a lot of that can lead to paralysis. Like when I have been on a team with Alex before I had the confidence, this was like years ago. Maybe one of my first team, it was a team constructed, but not unified. It was separated by format. I was playing standard, and I was with Alex and Pascal Maynard. So we were favored to be one of the best teams in the tournament. But, you know, I had to ask Alex because I wasn't sure a lot of decisions, and it distracted him from his game and it delayed my game, et cetera. So there's a lot of cost behind that. And then a lot, you know, there were people complaining on Twitter that, you know, this sort of WMCQ system does not lead to the best team. But again, when you looked at how stacked Canada was and USA was with between having Sigrist, Martel, and Neil Oliver on the team, all known stars, it's hard to surely they're not the three best American players, but they're pretty damn good. So I don't know, man.
I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of a weird problem to have where how do you determine, like, with an event like the World Magic Cup, how do you determine the three best players? You know, I mean, do you, because one of those legs could very well be in the current WMCQ system, the dude who spiked the tournament that he went to, you know, it could be his sixth, seventh or eighth tournament or whatever. And he just, you know, he hasn't really done anything. He's maybe dropped out of his first GP or whatever, but then he just spikes the WMCQ. Right. I mean, crazier things have happened. These are big tournaments, but they're not like, I mean, they're like old PTQ big. And, you know, I've known crazy things to happen at old PTQs. So, but do you looking at that system, there's obviously a weakness there, but then do you go to the best, like, pro points at large? Do you give the pros an additional event to play, you know, to do well in, and do you reward the people who are grinding GPs and stuff? I don't know. It's kind of an interesting situation.
Right. You bring up a good point, because at the same time, you want to leave that chance for anybody to feel like they could make it without having to play the whole year.
Yeah.
Like you want to bring all these more, I wouldn't say casual competitive, but competitive players that aren't playing professionally. Like Alex Hain, this is his job. He's playing professionally. He, like, professional Magic player is actually, like, before I thought it was just like a fake thing that people would say, but that is his, you know, job title. He is a professional Magic player. And to have to compete, if we gave like three slots to the top, at large, we would have better teams, and maybe we just leave that one spot for one special player to make it. But then it's like, where would you host that tournament for one guy to make it, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's tough. Like, everyone misses nationals, and I personally do as well, because our country is so, both of our countries are so large geographically. Having one tournament to bring everyone together, a lot of Canadians from the Western side that I get to see. And then we get tested in this double format where we're tested on draft and constructed in a 2-day event, made it special. And, you know, and when you win, you got to spend a bit of time with the people that you top forward with.
Yeah, that's the problem with Magic right now that I think WASI really has to figure out. Is that so? When I went to work the Modern Masters GP in Japan, I had a really long conversation with some of the players from Singapore, and, you know, we got to talking, and they love the WMCQ and the PPTQ system. They love it because they're a super small, super dense country. Whereas, you know. The solution that works for us and has worked for us for many, many, many years, because Wizards is a North American company, has not been serving, you know, Asia and Europe very well. So that's, I kind of wonder how they're going to figure this out, because this is a problem. I myself miss regionals and nationals. I loved nationals. Nationals was just like this fantastic, like an even more open pro tour. So I miss it as well, KYT.
Yeah, but I know for whatever reasons they want to keep it consistent throughout the world. So I don't expect me to get that nationals
back anytime soon.
Italy ended up winning, and congrats to them. Hats off to them for being able to come together and take home the championship. Like, yeah, Andrea Mangucci won, and I've talked about him with your chick, how we basically took his abs at aggro list to some sort of success. Me and a shitty GPT, local GPT, and him, the biggest TCG player tournament of the year. And now just to talk a little bit about the SCG tournaments. Again, I haven't really been keeping track, but it seems like the Mangucci list is, again, doing really well in whether it be the Standard Open or the Invitational, because the Standard Open in the finals was BBD with Jeskai Black, and he beat Steve Rubin with Abzan Aggro with a list that looks basically like the Mangucci list, if not card for card. But he also had Surge of Righteousness. But it's basically really close. And in the Invitational, the winner in Standard also played Abzan Aggro in a very similar list, but instead of Heir of the Wilds, he opted for some Snapping Gnarlids, which is very interesting to me.
Yeah. So who won that event?
Caleb Schurer.
Oh, did you say Caleb Schurer?
Yeah, I did.
So my friend Caleb Schurer won the Invitational.
Your friend? Are you serious? Is he actually your friend?
Yes. So yeah, we met in St. Louis while I was running my shop in St. Louis, and he is actually from Columbia, Missouri. He is currently a grad student, and he actually says that he. So he posted a photo of the big check on his desk at work. I believe it was on his desk at work, and he says he points to it. He will now point to it and tell his maths and analytics students that it actually pays off. So, but yeah, he has actually he switched to Abzan Aggro for a little while ago. A lot of us that know him are really kind of worried because he moved away from playing mountains, which is very uncharacteristic for him. He plays, because he also plays Storm in every format, but like where he can't play Storm, he plays mountains. And then so he switched to Abzan Aggro and has been grinding the SCG circuit for a while. And we have actually set up an interview with him. I will record that later tonight, away from KYT, because he's so busy with his working at face to face. So I'm actually going to talk to him later tonight, and we're going to air that interview as part of this episode.
Sweet, sweet. I would love to know, like, the decision to go on Snapping Gnarlid, because, I mean, it's super aggressive with all the fetch lands, but so is Heir of the Wild a lot of time.
Yeah.
And Heir of the Wilds can safely trade with a Siege Rhino. So that's definitely a question that I want you to ask him, because that's probably one of the bigger change. And plus, what's specific to him is he has four Pitiless Horde, the 5/3 for two colors and one black, Orc Berserker. At the beginning of your upkeep, you lose two life and dash, two black and two colorless. Very interesting.
I mean,
maybe against control.
He has to play haste creatures somewhere. If he can't play mountains, he has to play haste creatures.
But, well, yeah, maybe. I guess that's why. I guess that's why he has them.
I'll let him talk to us about that.
So that wraps up my quick thoughts. We're going to get a lot more standard content after the segment with Mendoza and Caleb.
So quick, before we move to that, quick WMCQ question that Kyle brought up, mentioned that people were talking about on Twitter, that Sigrist and and Martell were talking about how if their seats were switched, they would have had a completely different day. Now, my question is, I have my theory on it, but do you think that the A and like who sits in A and who sits in C in team tournaments matters at all?
It doesn't matter if it really depends on the, you mean, depends what you're asking, I guess. If it didn't matter if all three of you are like comparable skill level, but
no. I'm saying that I agree. And I think that you're about to say that the B seat absolutely matters. Cause you put your, right. You put your strongest player in the middle.
Right. If like the two guys on your flank are significantly weaker and need like some sort of advice mid game. But I don't know. You can ask this question and mean different things. Okay. Like, does it matter in terms of matchups? Like, does it matter? Like, people are like, oh man, some people have these theories where you put the aggro deck in the middle or the control deck in the middle or whatever. Because like you put the aggro guy in the middle because he can finish his match quick and help A or C, or you put the control guy in the middle so that once A or C finish, they can help the B player. So there's like all these different theories.
Yeah.
And to the point where like when I played and I finished fifth at GP Providence a long time ago with my team, and did okay, didn't do well, like 6-3, last round for day two at GP Portland. Both times we weren't really, we didn't really care. So,
okay. That's my theory on it, is that A and C, like, it just doesn't matter. Like whether you put A or, you know, if you're trying to metagame, oh, these, you know, A versus C, I think it's just a moot point and you should move on.
Right. I think they look back on it, but at the same time, you had to know what games you were going to play in A and C. Like, it doesn't matter. It's just hindsight 2020.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people think that a lot of people complain about Unified Standard because sometimes, like my friend Justin Richardson, he was a Tarka Red and he just happened to play against Four Color Rally, a bad matchup. But that's just how it rolls. I mean, even if you made it team constructed where it's separated by format, like Modern, Legacy and Standard, if I'm playing, you know, Affinity and the guy in front of me is somehow playing a deck that crushes Affinity, like Splinter Twin or something, which I mean, that's just how it goes. Like, you're gonna sit in front of a bad matchup like in any tournament, and you can't really, it's not something that you can control or do. I don't think you can do anything. You just have to say, oop, like,
yeah. So question,
I'm bad.
Well, I think that so you mentioned that because I did see Four Color Rally in some teams, but one thing that I noticed was that like almost every team had some sort of red green aggro deck. Now the question here is, if you are a team that is choosing to play Four Color Rally, do you put Four Color Rally in an A or a C spot, or do you put it with your the strongest player in the B spot? Because the A and the C, I would imagine, are going to be mostly, or you're basically going to have a slightly under 50-50 shot of playing, you know, you're going to have a very good chance of playing a Tarka Red at the A or the C spot. So what do you think? What are your thoughts?
I think I'm going back to what I earlier said. I don't think I think too much about it.
Okay.
I give it to the guy who's going to play the deck the most, which is, I mean, it's not going to, if I'm on the team, it's not going to be me. So, and you know, I might not be the weakest or strongest player. I might be stronger than the rally player, but the rally player just like plays a rally deck really well. So it's like, he's got to have to take that deck, and where he sits, man, it's tough. And I'm not even sure how much it matters when it's like a feature match, how they do it. Like, they're,
yeah.
So I think, I mean, if I was with Alex, you know, Alex knows he's probably sitting in the middle. So that's how it goes. Anyways, moving on to something else, totally different. Something that you had mentioned before last show. You wanted to talk to me about codenames a bit, and because of the hype around Magic tournaments, like people like Alex Magilaton buying multiple copies of codenames just to sell it to fellow players who get hooked on it at GPs because people are playing it and want to buy it immediately. He's been buying them for a lot of friends and posting pictures about them. I'm like, every weekend I see him buying another two copies, and we've still been sold out. I think every distributor that we work with is still sold out. So this game is a huge hit.
Yeah, I couldn't get mine at... I bought a copy. I couldn't get mine from my LGS, and I have three of them. And I actually found mine. I was buying like a random comic at Hastings and just walked by the shelf and was like, I wonder if they have codenames. And I looked down and it's like the box on the top of the shelf, like right in front of my face. And I'm like, yep, I'm buying this. But yeah, I love codenames. That's games. The game is awesome. I just had a rules question for you more than anything.
Okay.
So I was a little confused because the directions say that you can get. So do you bank guesses? So for example, if say like I give you a clue that's like red two.
Right.
So you guess incorrectly the first time. So the next time, if I'm your spy master, I give you the clue grass three. So say you take all three guesses for grass. Say you like guess this for grass, this for grass, this for grass. Do you get another guess for red? Or do you just get the addition, the bonus additional guess? Does that make sense?
You get the bonus additional guess.
Okay.
And that you, yeah, I think that's all you get, but you just use that for your red clue is how we've been playing it.
Okay.
And I have to read the whole manual again to be like to play it the absolute like rules Nazi way, because there's a lot of people once you start setting up the board, there's types of people who will try to do anything to like skew with the rules. I don't know if there's a lot of people in your play group that are like that. So basically, if they see the grid, if their grid is like all five words at the top, right? Okay. Instead of saying an actual clue, what you're supposed to do in the game actually says you're supposed to say a word that relates to all five of your words.
Okay.
His first game, he goes top five. Basically trying to get me to pick all five that are on the top grid. But because I'm on, like, it was funny. I let him do that, whatever. It's his first game. But because we were sitting across from each other, I was picking his what appeared to be his top five, but he was looking at it from my angle.
Oh no.
So it screwed him over completely. But still, you have a lot of players that will try to skew the rules like that, and some of it like and then there's people who can't really keep a straight face because you're not supposed to really tell someone if they incorrectly get something right. Like for the wrong clue, right? For the wrong reasons, right? I'm not sure you're supposed to tell that. Like, let's say you say red two and I pick something that is correct on your grid, but it has nothing to do with red. Like, it has nothing to do with your original clue. Then you can't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then you have people who are like, wow, that's pretty lucky. And then it's like, well, that means there's two other cards associated to red. So, you know, it's a lot more fun if you play with people who are like going by the book for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Because I know that in the case of that, like top five, like if I had been another spy master, like you can absolutely invalidate the other spy the clues that you're the other spy master gives if they're not valid clues.
No, right, right.
So I definitely like encourage my players to utilize that rule. But no, that was my question. And then you can guess, you can say unlimited as like tree unlimited.
I think so.
Okay, because I didn't think that was a... I didn't think you could actually do that.
It gives... Again, I'm going to have to read the whole manual again, but it gives it so your last turn, you can just go... Like, if you're losing, right? If you know you're losing, and the opposing team only has one word left, and you have three, then you have to say, like, something random, and then you say two, so he has to get the two and the words. So you have to say some big number, especially if maybe, let's say, you're five words behind. And it makes things interesting because there have been times where I've lost, where the opposing team was behind and they got it with a last-minute guess, and it was pretty exhilarating.
Okay.
Still lost, but still.
I guess at that point, like, really the statistics, I mean, unlimited is the same as, like, it is probably just the same as, like, 5 to 10.
Right.
So, okay.
That's our little segment. For all you listeners who don't play it, get the game. For all of you who have the game, hit us up with how much you love the game as well. I also got recently Exploding Kittens because it was like the greatest Kickstarter, like the most funded game of all time. And even though the reviews on Board Game Geek aren't that good, the reviews on Amazon are pretty good, and I played it, and I think it's quite the good party game. I would recommend it.
It was okay.
It's not as great as Codenames because it doesn't have the whole awesome strategy slant to it, but I didn't think I would have so much fun, but at the employee Christmas party we just had, when it was five players and there's two people really going after each other, we had a hilarious time.
Okay.
I guess it didn't work out for you, Matt.
Yeah, we just had a lot of... I haven't played it in a party context. So that's probably where I played with like a couple other gamers, and we just kind of like... We played a lot of Drago, and then... I don't know. It didn't really catch me. But yeah, I'll have to play it at a party. So all right, wrapping up our standard segment, we're just going to kick it to that interview with the most recent SCG Invitational standard champion playing Caleb Scherer playing Abzan Aggro. Enjoy. All right, everybody, I'm here with Caleb Scherer.
Hey, everyone.
The most recent SCG Invitational champion and St. Louis darling. We kind of go back to when I used to run a shop here in St. or not here in St. Louis, but in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And so you recently won the SCG Invitational. And one, you said your occupation was a student. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
So basically, other than when I'm not like traveling to opens and playing Magic, I'm currently a graduate student at the University of Missouri Columbia, and I'm actually studying math, so in their PhD program. So I'm a student, but I'm also a TA, so kind of the usual gig for most grad students. So it's teacher by day, and then basically Magic player on the weekends.
And what are you getting your PhD in?
Currently, like, my area that I'm working in is differential geometry. Okay. So basically, kind of the simplest way to describe it is I play with calculus on funky shapes. So
I always found geometry to be the hardest of the maths that I took.
Yeah, it's kind of another world. Like, you have like kind of there's the division in math people, which is you're either an algebraist or a geometer analyst. So basically, either you sit around and you play with shapes in your head, or you just push symbols around. It's kind of like, you know, kind of usually how the inside joke goes. So, okay. Yeah.
And then let's tie that your education. How is that affecting your Magic career?
I'd say that it's been an insanely good boon for it. I mean, of course, there's the, hey, you're good at numbers, and with Magic, you're constructing decks, you want to know the odds of stuff, and so forth. So that's kind of the, well, of course. But then also just, like, the general problem-solving skill set as well, if you want to expand, is just, like, an amazing thing for even like, you know, anyone who's listening to that, you know, just an undergrad math student. There's so many skills that you're just learning that are just amazing for magic. Even if you, you know, you just have to, if you're like, the whole point of mathematics is you get a system and a set of rules, and then you exploit the rules as hard as humanly possible to get what you want. Sounds very similar to a lot of magic formats. So yeah, I mean, like, that's also a great skill set. Of course, the probability and statistics being very, very huge in that, you can kind of like go about being like, hey, or what's the likelihood he'll draw this, kind of giving yourself ballpark numbers, or even just, hey, how many of a certain effect in my deck do I want to see X number in a game based on how many I want to see, you know, through an average, you know, kind of like a match and so forth.
Okay. Kind of
pretty awesome.
Yeah. And so, I saw your funny picture where you posted your $10,000 check and you point at it.
Yeah.
when is that? You pointed it when your students ask what?
Basically, if they like, since currently I actually teach finite math for business students, that has a very bit, that has a probability and statistics section. So kind of some basic stuff that's, you know, dealing with poker hands, or, you know, other stuff they would see in the business world, like very similar combinatorics to magic. So it's more like, you know, they'll ask me like, hey, like, you know, how can I kind of get by on this? I don't really need to learn this. And then it's like, this is, you know, they always like, you know, there's no practical application to math is kind of the you know, general saying, right? And then I'm just like, well, I mean, literally what I'm teaching you guys about how to calculate what's the odds to get like a two pair in your hand, kind of those similar techniques is what I'm kind of having to do on the fly sometimes, do play magic on the weekends. So and clearly there's, you know, it can pay dividends, you know, a little bit. Yeah.
So have you switched to poker yet? Have you done anything with that yet?
I would like to. I actually went and played poker in like real life at a casino for the very first time in Vegas. Was down about $50. So, you know, I'm not amazing in any way. You know, I was definitely going to get sharked, but it was still fun. Like, you know, something in the future that I could look into. Since in undergrad, I used to, in St. Louis, in order to like basically pay for going out money, me and my one friend would actually go to the, like, over in East St. Louis on like the very low $5 tables and kind of count cards just to make a few bucks. So, okay.
Yeah. What did you learn playing poker in Vegas?
Basically that I'm very bad.
Well, what part of your game needs to, like, what part of your game do you need to improve?
I think I really need to, it kind of just through repetition, just get the odds down a lot better in my head. I know I derped a few times on calculations, and got punished for it a few times, and just like, you know, learning the psychological aspect, like there's so much, not like trash talk as people like to say, but, you know, just like so much of a psychological game that people try to play with you at tables too. Yeah. Which is kind of course, me being a math guy, that's like the realm that I have to learn. So I there's so much room to expand, but also I mean even though I, you know, didn't do so also hot, I had an amazing time. I just did that for hours, and I don't know, it just sounds like a fun idea. Like, cool. Going forward.
Mm-hmm. And so your magic career has basically kind of been broken into two, can be broken into two sections, where you, it's basically your pre-SCG grinder days, mm-hmm. when you were kind of flirting with competitive magic and you did a bunch of different things. And then your SCG grinder days, which is like the past year or so, right? Basically.
Yeah. Basically, like hardcore SCG grinding about either since, you could say Indianapolis in January of this year, or I guess technically the Invitational in December last year, right before the Players Champs, in 2014.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So talk about your time. What kind of brought you to magic, and then what kind of brought you to competitive magic, and mm-hmm. then what kind of allowed you to transition out, of general competitive magic to the SCG circuit specifically?
Okay. Well, for me, I've been playing off and on as far as like very competitive since I was 12. So, being in, like my generation, like, you know, late 20s, we were the Pokemon kids in the late 90s. Right. So That was my very first foray into card games, actually, was, hey, I was really bad at sports and all that stuff. And then I saw that everyone's playing with these shiny Pokemon cards, and oh, there's a game attached. And okay, I love doing math and puzzles. So I just started getting into that competitively, locally. And a few of the older guys who were kind of like straddling both games were like, hey, do you want to come on, like, you know, before FNM was a thing, but like Friday Night Magic, when it was just actually called that locally, you know, everywhere, was, hey, come play Magic with us. And I was like, okay, I'll learn the rules. And then that was around Invasion. And then basically my first PTQ was Invasion Block Constructed. So I went all in there and played all out throughout high school. I took a hiatus for college since I was going at that point in time, I wanted to go full PhD track, professor, all in. So I kind of had to put an ixnay on competitive Magic for playing. I kept up with it as much as possible, reading, of course. And then I had a brief grinding stint after undergrad, where for a summer, I decided to, with my friend Josh Lalo, just say, hey, I have a summer off with, you know, with no job, so let's see if I can qualify for a pro tour finally, since I had a fair amount of like second place PTQ finishes from years prior. So it was just kind of, you know, that bug.
Uh-huh.
And interestingly, I ground that whole summer, didn't manage to win a PTQ, but under the old ELO system, which is the old rating system for any of those unfamiliar, that's based on the chess rating system, they used to award invites to the top 100 ranked composite players, so i.e. like your complete rating, including limited and constructed. Mm-hmm. And I actually managed to get an invite that way.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. It was amazing and it was for Pro Tour Amsterdam in 2010. So, you know, also I get to go to Europe. Amazing stuff.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then the very first week of grad school is, lo and behold, the entire week and a half that I would have to be in Amsterdam. So for the pro tour, and since I knew no one, and then I even talked to like all the people, you know, like, hey, is there any way I'm able to like do this in the department? And basically it was at that point in time, okay, you either get to be in grad school or you can go to the pro tour. And since it was just a pro tour that I just queued for over the summer, it wasn't like I, you know, spent all of undergrad doing this. I made the decision, interestingly, that grad school was more important than Magic. Yeah, so I took that
poor decision, mind you.
Exactly. And stuck in grad school for a few years, had a lot going on. And then, interestingly, my third year in, I was roommates with my roommate, Ross Holly, actually, was like one day, hey, you know, since I didn't know him before, it was a roommate matching system. Hey, I found out he played Magic, and I happened to have an old High Tide deck sitting, you know, in my stuff still that I had. So I was like, okay, we can jam. And eventually a year later, he convinced me to get a deck and go to an IQ, and then was like, hey dude, we should plan a trip to Grand Prix Richmond, which was Modern at the time. And I was like, okay. And then proceeded to get that, and then met some other grinders in Columbia, where I'm based here in Columbia, Missouri, going to school here, and went to that, moneyed, and felt like, hey, I also have a semester off right now, since I was also taking a semester off of classes at that point and just teaching. So I have the time and ability to grind. So let's just see what I can do if I put my all into Magic again. And kind of just went from there for that year being kind of like my pre-SCG days, where it'd be, hey, if there's either a close GP within driving distance or an open, you know, choose whatever, and you know, is mm-hmm. most applicable, and just kind of jam that. That was kind of my 2014 plan, just kind of hanging around. And also, of course, still playing as much Legacy as humanly possible. But
don't worry, yeah. We'll get to that.
Oh, yeah. So that was kind of that's kind of my history in that, but like pre-SCG, basically all up until basically December 2014 when I went to the Invitational in Seattle.
Okay. And was that your first major, like, premier level, premier-ish level tournament?
In Seattle?
Yeah, I mean, you played in a couple Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Had you day-tuned previously or anything?
At Grand Prix, yes. My very first Grand Prix I played in was in 2005 in Minneapolis, and I made top 32 there. And then I also, at Grand Prix Richmond, managed to finish in the top 150.
Okay.
The one that had, like, 4,000 people. So, like, I mean, I'd done decently well at, and then even in the one in Minneapolis, again, like, you know, Modern, that spring of 2014, about summer, I managed to day two that and missing money on tiebreaks. So, you know, doing decently well on the Grand Prix circuit, given that I didn't play as much for a while. Okay. So I had done decently well, but nothing even close to what happened in Seattle for me.
Yeah, so let's talk about Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do that, what happened that changed the course of, your plans?
Well, so I went to Seattle. I was actually going there with my roommate at the time, and we had no plans actually for 2015 just yet as far as grinding. So this was a quote-unquote last hurrah for me, as in kind of end of the line, but it was more like kind of a splitting, you know, since a lot of my friends who I'd been traveling with from Columbia were going back into school and stuff, so it would be kind of me on my own or in a rebuilding phase. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of actually interestingly at a crux at moment in time for it. And what changed it was, well, I mean, I went there, did quite well for myself. I managed to make top four. So that also gave, you know, of course, you know, with doing well on the circuit, I have like, you know, some notoriety now and the ability and the funds to actually travel now since, you know, of course, still being in school.
Yeah.
To the stuff the next year. So I was like, okay, I'll, you know, at least through the first like quarter, let's see what I can do. I had no aspirations of Players Championship or anything like that, you know, with the grind yet, because that's like, you know, an all in effort. You have to go to every open you can, stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, you literally, I know that following you, you literally go to anything that offers an SCG point.
Basically. Exactly.
So, and then, okay, so how has the SCG circuit been for you?
I think it has been amazing. It's really awesome that, hey, it's a circuit that, you know, of course, based in the States, so, you know, domestic travel being much easier. And just, I mean, one of the other things is meeting all sorts of other grinders who are also in that same stage. You know, awesome guys who, you know, we're all kind of like, hey, we're wanting to get into a competitive circuit, but, you know, we're not just going to jump all in on the pro tour since those guys are just insane. Mm-hmm. They're so great. And it's like, you know, kind of a nice stepping stone to where we're all like, we want to do this, you know, camaraderie. And then just, you know, there is a stepping stone to the next level, which is the pro tour. So, I mean, it's an amazing growing experience. It's just like the perfect thing to have for us, I think, like, you know, just the secondary circuit, which, you know, personally, I just have the most fun on it of all time, and getting to play Legacy more often and a Modern, of course, being great.
Yeah. So let's move on to the actual decks that you play. Now, you're known to play, I was joking in the podcast that when you play every Storm in every format it's legal, and then in the formats that it's not, you play Mountains.
Yeah.
With the exception of Bant Heroic. And then your most recent standard deck was Abzan Aggro. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about your legacy decks. Like, what kind of combo decks do you play, and what kind of draws you to them?
For me personally, the most fun combo decks for myself are, I guess this is like a weird way to look at it, but like deterministic combo. So you play, it's kind of like, you know, like Storm, where you feel, okay, I'm casting a bunch of spells in sequence and so forth, hoping to get the, you know, the whatever lethal storm count or past in flames for those of you familiar with Legacy and so forth, to just cast your spell and then it copies itself a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. But of course, like for Storm and Legacy, you kind of think of it as, okay, this is exactly what will happen. I'm not just kind of hoping that the engine that is my deck will give me like a 90% confidence interval of getting there all the time. Sometimes you have to do that. So that's usually what I'm kind of drawn to, is stuff of that nature. Just very interesting, complex combo. Like I've even tried it out in standard, like, you know, with Jeskai Ascendancy combo. I played that at one open, you know, stuff like that, to where you're just, you know, kind of looking for that. Where basically you get to play solitaire as much as humanly possible. Kind of a good way to describe it, I guess. stuff like that is usually what I'm very much drawn to. Also, like I do like engine based combos, so very similar to High Tide or Modern Storm. Kind of that type of deal where you're just going through your deck, trying to cast like a sufficient critical mass to slowly get the ball rolling to a certain point.
Okay. And then what's your current Legacy deck?
Currently I am playing Ad Nauseam Tendrils.
Okay.
Legacy. Mm-hmm.
And why that?
I think personally it is the most powerful Storm deck in the format. And it just has so much versatility. Well, first, of course, I get to play with my favorite Storm mechanic, like, you know, of course. And also, kind of like my reasoning for choosing Ant in particular was, well, hey, I actually played Ant for quite a bit when it first, I guess, in its current form came out, quote unquote.
Okay.
At Grand Prix Columbus in 2010, Ari Lax played the Grim Tutor version for the first time, right after the banning of Mystical Tutor with all the cantrips and two Grim Tutor for Infernal. and back before Past and Flames made everything awesome. So I played that for about a year and a half, or actually almost 2 years, sorry. So I have that kind of skill set. So then basically once I jump back in, I actually, interestingly enough, my very first coverage match of Star City is me and Legacy playing a Burn deck. so I played Burn for a little while as I had to actually sell off my High Tide deck to pay rent. Since a few guys in Colombia actually had the deck built and I was able to borrow it for the Jersey Grand Prix and even the Seattle Invitational. So I'd been preparing with that. So that's why I'm now on kind of that exact list.
Okay. And moving on to Modern. What? Mm-hmm. So previously in Modern, you used to play Storm.
Yes.
But you have since realized that it is an actual tier two deck.
Yes.
which I realized once they banned Seething Song, I was like, the dream is dead. The dream mm-hmm. is dead. Because I loved Storm too. but what do you play now?
Currently, I'm actually playing Affinity.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, kind of like, luckily, I've at least stayed to my broken roots. So,
okay. But, and what version do you play?
Currently, I actually play a four thought cast version with zero Galvatas.
Okay.
So, kind of a more, I guess, quote unquote, old school version is what you'd say. I actually have this list. It's my good buddy Ryan Fleischer actually came up with this list precisely and played it in Columbus where he made top 16 with a few unique touches such as the four thought cast, no Galv Blast, so you pretty much forfeit the twin matchup, but if they combo you out, and you just pretend it doesn't exist, and you also run a basic swamp instead of the usual basic mountain or island.
Okay, with the presumption that if they path, you can have another access to Cranial Plating mana.
Exactly, since that's usually kind of what you want to be doing if they're killing your creatures with one for one, right?
yep. Mm-hmm. So that version, you used that version to play in play half of the Invitational.
Yep.
How did your Modern portion go?
My Modern portion, I actually went 6-1-1, being able to luckily draw in the very last round of Modern to secure my place in top 8.
Okay. And in a nutshell, how do you think the deck performed for you and do you like that version? Are you still like committed to that version? And do you see any changes going forward?
For myself, I personally think the deck is amazing. It felt like just this insanely well-oiled machine of kind of playing with it. Of course, Affinity, there's always the super insanely broken draws of turn one, dump my hand, look at my board, I have infinite everything. But, just even when you don't do that, it just felt so resilient. Also, just with the podcast, kind of one thing that Ryan told me was basically what Affinity, what he said is Affinity needs to hit 10 or 11 cards. That's kind of your, literal the blob effect, right? So it becomes, Affinity then just becomes this unstoppable blob at roughly that level of synergy, and with component parts, mm-hmm. to where it's going to kill you. And after goldfishing, a bunch of games, getting it on Moto and then proxying it up in real life, it was consistently, just keeping track of the numbers, oh man, when I'm hitting about 10, about a sixth of my deck, that's the critical mass of getting there. If they solve, obviously, then of course, if they kill the one or two linchpins holding it together, you can lose, but that's exactly where you want to be. And Thoughtcast sort of accelerates that clock by just, being an all-in machine of onboard.
Okay. And you didn't miss the interaction with the interaction in the form of Galvanic Blast?
No, not at all, actually. Game one. It felt very much like how I kind of generally like my quote-unquote unfair decks to function, which is game one, you have an advantage, so push that advantage to its maximum, which is don't try to be cute. I mean, of course, hedging is great and so forth, and maybe I'm not hedging the PC, but stuff like that. Just in a general field, I would just rather keep if you accept what you can and cannot lose to. Well, I mean, what's my point in trying to prepare for their, if I can't beat Lightning Bolt turn three X or turn four twin, why try to give myself 5% of the games I might see one of the cards? to, you know, deal with when, hey, they probably don't always have it on turn four either. I mean, everyone's seen twin. It's always the fear. It's not the actual combo that's always killing you on turn four.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So let's kind of fast forward to standard. Now, you had previously been playing a whole bunch of red decks in standard, but you just within the last couple months switched to Abzan aggro. What inspired that switch?
Well, what inspired it was, so once the battle for Zendikar rotated in and threw everything on its head, heroic's gone. That was my non-Mountain deck before, as you mentioned, and I have to start from scratch. So week one, of course, I played Mountains in Indianapolis at the Open. I was playing a kind of more aura-based version that had four Call of the Full Moon and all that good stuff before everyone discovered that Silcrap was basically the best two mana removal in the format, and it felt great. And then I saw the results of the PT and was like, okay, I guess we're not doing that again since the Silcrap's there. So I need a new deck. I've been all over the place. In Atlanta, I played Esper Walker control, so and went 5-2-2. So two intentional draws. So, you know, as you can tell, I'm not a control player. And
two unintentional draws, right?
Correct. Yeah, okay. Yeah, two unintentional draws. And then I was just still kind of moseying around, couldn't really settle on anything. So for Kansas City, I finally was like, well, Abzan aggro, it's pretty solid. I've never really played with Siege Rhinos and stuff. So, and it's always been, it, and kind of the mantra for the last three sets has been, the set's released, and then it takes, you know, it's like how long until someone figures out the Abzan aggro build that beats everything. And so I was like, okay, maybe I'll try this out. Tried it with Heir of the Wilds. Felt great. I made day two, then lost round one of day two and did my legacy thing. But the deck felt great. Like, it wasn't, you know, it's like, okay, this is powerful. I think I want to stick with this.
Okay.
And did it there. And then I, you know, luckily the next weekend I got to play, it was Jersey, so I had to take a week off of more standard testing. And then in Denver, I actually played the deck again, this time now with Snapping Gnarlids. That card is amazing.
Don't spoil it.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your Abzan aggro deck going into the Invitational.
Okay.
You made a pretty interesting choice in not choosing Heir of the Wilds or Hangerback Walker and instead going a Snapping Gnarlid.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, to be like perfectly honest, so I did actually try Air, as I mentioned. I played Air in Kansas City. Card felt fine. You know, hey, this is way better than Hangerback Walker in my opinion, because, you know, you're an aggro deck and Hangerback Walker kind of walks that fine line of, hey, I'm resilient, but I mean, if you cast me on turn two, attacking for one on three, or just leaving up a mana so I can't play an Anofenza feels really bad.
Yeah.
So I was immediately off of that card before. But then I, like with Heir of the Wilds, one thing that I was noticing, and this is some tech that I actually took from Chris Anderson's list at that actual open, was he had four Snapping Gnarlids with the same mana base, which is 12 fetch lands and kind of the very standard stock version of Abzan aggro. So my thinking was, well, I mean, attacking for four, it's going to basically always be as big as Heir of the Wild. So it's a 3-3 on your turn when you're trying to be aggressive. Because also Heir never triggers on their turn since it has to be attacking.
Makes sense.
Exactly. So it's always vulnerable to Wild Slash. This way you can actually have a 4-4, which then beats, since the mirror match is about a third of every field nowadays in general, they go turn, even if you're on the play, you go turn one, like land, turn two Gnarlid, they go turn one Warden, and if they don't have a turn two play, they can easily just trade a 3-3 for your 3-3 if you want to. But with Snapping Gnarlid, you can play a land, fetch land four, you know, something like that.
Okay.
Against a Warden and so forth. And of course, if there's, you know, it trades with Heir of the Wild still, but so would your Heir of the Wilds if that was there too.
Yeah.
And also, another thing being, holding up fetch lands on their turn gives you a little bit of resiliency against Wild Slash and so forth, because then you can make it really awkward for them when they want to cast spells, since a lot of this format is very, very, very punishing for mismanagement of mana, and casting two spells in one turn can just like be the make or break in any game on like even just turn four, just because you were able to, you know, kind of break serve at some point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that makes sense. And then, so looking over your list, everything else seems pretty stock.
Mm-hmm.
you mentioned the 12 fetch mana base, but then you get to the sideboard and you have these four pitiless hordes. What's going on with that?
Well, so one thing that has been a massive problem for Obzon aggro, and what's really been coming out of the woodwork to just crush it recently, has been four color rally and Esper dragons and ramp decks.
Okay.
So there's one thing that's, and then also there's one thing that Obzon aggro has that no other deck in the format does, which is if you curve out, you win, basically. Like, that's kind of the ethos of the deck, or the draw, right? Uh-huh. If you go like, you know, one drop, two drop, or like 2, 3, 4, you know, with either Gnarladair, etc. And so against those decks, when I'm winning games, it's always curve out, and just being as aggressive as possible to put them on the back foot, because their turn 7 or 8 plans, aka the long game, is unbeatable for you. Like Ugin, Rally the Ancestors for infinite after they bounce your Inoffensive, yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah, that seems so it's like, bad.
Yeah, you have no way to fight them on their axis. So my thinking was, how can I be faster? Like, how can I just be a more consistent, just bash your face in engine? Kind of like, you know, going back to red decks. And lo and behold, in Denver, Logan Myers top 8-ed with Obzon aggro with four Pitiless Horde in his board. And I, of course, had to look up what that card was. And I was like, wow, this exists. And this card is insane, because it fits on curve with Inoffensive, in that since in most decks, what you want is, in order to have a consistent drop at each one, you want 6 to 8 of that number, just, you know, for consistency reasons. So then, okay, I have now 7 or 8 three drops that are all just massive bashings. You know, it's okay, attack for 4 or 5 off of, like, actually, they all both contribute exactly 5 power to the board, technically, if there's other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of giving you just, you're literally just trying to expand the best strength that Obzon aggro has. And then also again, and that's for against ramp and rally, where you're just jamming a 3-drop and just turning everything sideways. And then of course, against Esper, they have a lot of sorcery speed removal, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And just paying 4 mana to dash in a Black Lightning Axe, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. So, understandable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll kind of wrap up. The Invitational obviously went really well for you.
Mm-hmm.
Going forward, are there any changes you would recommend making to your list?
For my list of Obzon aggro?
Uh-huh.
Yes. Actually, there's a few things that I have been considering. One of them being the fact that I have 7 two drops, so not like super heavy, or I felt that was too many. But one thing that I noticed is to kind of bridge the gap on the curve is possibly running one Tasker over the fourth Gnarlid.
Okay.
Just to, because kind of like looking at your fetch mana base, is it's quote unquote 3-drop most of the time, because you'll have a 1 or a 2 and most of the time that dies, unless, or you're just, you know, then crushing them, which is great. So that, and plus 2 fetches then means turn 3 Tasiger, which then in essence is like a 5th Inoffensive. So you can kind of bridge that, while also it being an insane late game play where you can just pay it for 1 mana, like on turn 5, Tasiger, Siege Rhino, pretty good. So that is one area that I'm going to be looking into going forward as well. And then also in the sideboard, probably just looking for more things for the mirror match itself, since now going forward, I think that that's going to be also very popular again, since it kind of like took a little bit of a decline, you know, in Denver and the Invitational front, like it's still 20-something% of the meta, but something like that.
Okay. What kind of cards are you thinking about?
Basically what I'm looking at is maybe upping the control package, like for the mirror, as in, I currently run 2 Planar Outburst, maybe going up to 3 there, so you can be a true controlling build. Also, if you really expect a high amount, maybe even the 4th Den Protector, since in the mirror match, you want to chuck all your 2-drops out, except for the dens, the Den Protectors, so you can just, you're trying to be Obzon control from last season without Thoughtseize, is kind of your end goal.
Okay. Does that change, like, whether you're on the play or the draw?
It can, but what I've tried this on the draw, on the play as well, and what I've noticed is by going kind of more aggro-y on the play, where you want to leverage just the initiative, you're kind of playing a little bit more in variance than I feel is necessary, since you don't really have card draw in the mirror, cantrips or anything early. So you don't want to rely on your deck just handing you the curve out. So I'd rather be a little more on the defensive and be able to handle everything.
Okay,
just because you're trying to make the game go to turn 8 or 9. So, I mean, I don't want to try to, and since I don't, then I'd have to board probably some other tools on the board for to go faster, which I don't really want to do. And considering Kitless Horde is my fast option, and in a mirror, not really the best.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It dies to like everything,
basically.
All right, cool. Well, if anybody has any questions, where can they find you?
The best ways to reach me are basically I'm on either Facebook or Twitter. My Facebook is under Caleb Shear. Basically, you know, you can find me under my profile photo. It also has cover photo of cats, so any distinction. And then also I am on Twitter. You can feel free to tweet at me, follow me at CWSCHERER. So basically CW and then my last name is my Twitter handle as well.
All right. Well, mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Caleb. Congratulations on your success at the Invitational.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Did the Invitational win lock you for the Players Championship, or were you already locked for the Players Championship?
Actually, interestingly, I was outside of the Players Championship in the finals by 1 point. So,
wow.
In essence, it was exactly like Danny Jessup last year, where he was basically done all the work and got there. I was 1 point behind Tom Ross. So in essence, I needed 2. So, well, I need to get these 5 and then win the Invitational anyway. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck next week, and awesome. We'll keep following you.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on, man.
Yeah. Thanks for awesome. Taking the time with us.
All right. We'll talk to you later. Thanks.
Bye. All right. Welcome back. Thanks for listening to that interview. I'm sure he said some really great things about Storm and mountains.
And I'm back again.
And oh, KYC, hello.
I went back to being silent during the interview. So what I'm famous for.
But yeah, so okay. So KYT, were we actually going to do the 15 the year in?
Yeah.
Okay.
I like it.
Okay. So during this segment, we are going to actually talk about kind of a year in review. I was talking to KYT earlier and I mentioned how I wanted the last show of every year to kind of be like a year in review and our own sort of journey with Magic, and then kind of what we hope to achieve in 2016. We don't have to go into any specifics. I just wanted to kind of lay the groundwork for where we both want to be at and where we both have been. So, KYT. 2015, 4 stars, 5 stars. What do you give it? Why? What did you learn?
5 stars.
Okay.
A big 5 stars. Because looking back, it was time. People say time passes super fast, but sometimes it passes. It feels like it can pass slow sometimes because I felt like I was in Magic Origins, like Pro Tour Magic Origins ages ago, but it was just this past summer and it felt like at least a year ago to me.
Yeah, this year has felt full.
Right. So a lot of things, like I'm surprised that my very first Pro Tour was still this year, early February, when I was in Washington, D.C. with Xavier and Jessica. So that, to me, it's surprising that it's still the same year, and that's why I give it 5 stars. Can't really give, can't include the PTQ that clinched me to the first PT as part of it, but last year was when I finally won the big one after many trials. Ended up top 8ing in the core set and was really happy with myself, and headed into my first PT, day 2'd. At my first Pro Tour, which is something I was proud about, and was really proud that I didn't cheat in when I was
really proud that you didn't cheat. I hope you finished this sentence.
And yeah, I mean, there's a lot of how do I say? There's a lot of different rules where if you don't say anything, like you're almost incentivized not to say anything. So I was playing in my own version of Infect. Different from the Pro Tour version. I advocated playing black because at the time I felt like You need it more than just Glistener Elf in the format. You needed Evasion. You needed more than just Blight Agent. And Plague Stinger was just always the answer. And while playing against Mono Red in my testing, I learned that even though I Apostle's Blessing, a creature that is being Searing Blazed, I still take three. Right? And okay. I don't think my Mono Red opponents, or at least two of them, didn't know that. And I basically, when I did it, I reminded them. And you know how games of Magic can be super tight and modern against Mono Red. In fact, it could really come down to that extra 3 points. It's a fucking lightning bolt. Those three extra points of damage. And but, you know, I reminded him. And it's kind of weird because it's a rule that, you know, I'm just incentivized to just pretend myself that I don't know, right? Like that, you know, I have no idea. I mean, it makes sense. I'm protecting my creature. It should negate the entire spell, right? Like that type of thing. But it cost me the match. It cost me the match, which may have changed the whole result of my entire tournament, because I went from being 5-3 to 4-4. So who knows what else would have happened, especially since I started the limited portion, I believe 0-3. So I was like going for undefeated in modern. And then right after, I was really disappointed in my performance on day two. I felt like there were so many things that I could have done to play better, to place myself higher. And I was so angry at myself that I ended up asking people who wanted to go to the PTQ that was basically the very next weekend in Ottawa. I played Abzan midrange and went X1 into Swiss and basically 2-0'd the entire top 8. So I was feeling really good about myself, but I couldn't make it to Brussels. I had some family thing in Asia to attend to.
Okay.
So I had to postpone that to the following one, which is Magic Origins in Vancouver. Again, didn't do super well, but made day two and played my own version of green red Atarka ramp, and I still didn't feel out of place in that format. I mean, I didn't have a super team to give me blue red artifacts and soul artifact that blew the format wide open. I didn't have that, and with what I had, I thought I did really well. So. Still super pleased about that, but after making the two PTs, I didn't even play any pre-TQs anymore. The fire sort of dimmed towards other things on my plate. Like, there are just other real life priorities. I wouldn't say I've lost my passion for Magic, but I would say real life priorities just took a higher priority. Mm-hmm. And so my love for, you know, I'd rather, let's say on the weekend, work on something else than just like spend the whole day at a pre-TQ.
Yeah.
Is basically it.
So in terms of your other stuff, when did you start working at Face-to-Face this year?
I did.
Okay.
And I got hired which was sort of ill timing in terms of preparation for the PT, but I basically got hired a month before my second Pro Tour.
Okay.
So I wasn't going to take a week off, right? Like, I'm like, oh, I just got hired. I need a week, like, Sal, I need a week off because, you know, I need to test for the PT, especially since I'm one of their more important components. I'm like their content guy. I'm their website guy. Like, I was hired to play an extremely key role. And, you know, a lot of people will say that once you start working for a card store, either your skills degrade or your passion devolves. But it, you know, a lot of times it's just coincidence. It's because, mm-hmm. like, you work and then, you know, you have other responsibilities that come with it. It's hard. And a lot of people, like, even in Magic, you see them, they get a job, but once they've stabilized with their family life, they come back in the game much later and they stay there. Like,
yeah,
Finkel keeps playing, and a lot of these older guys who come back, William Jensen hasn't quit since his comeback. So, you know, people take these certain breaks, and even Paul Cheon, right, had to, I guess, get married, have a kid, and now he's sort of back full time. So I'm sort of in that little break zone, I would say. But and I need something. I do need something to get me extremely motivated. As I've talked about how I've sort of like been content. One of the reasons I got back into Magic, which is a funny story, to me it's a funny story to me and my close friends, is that I got back into competitively when someone just beat, like, I played really early on, then played a bit, and then someone beat the shit out of me with an annoying horseshoe crab deck.
Earthcraft horseshoe crab?
No, I don't think so. I think this was more casual. He had something that, I don't know, bounced my whole board every turn or something crazy where I was completely helpless and just embarrassed me in a dozen games or something that for some reason pushed me to say, you know what, I'm going to come back and destroy him. and that's what happened. Or he stopped playing, but like if he did play, I would destroy him.
So it's, what you're saying is that at every event now, it's okay for people to bring their horseshoe crabs up to you for signature?
Hope not.
I'm totally going to.
It's like this infinite combo. And then I think about my PT, my first PT where I day two'd, and I told you I failed day two. I felt like I failed on day two, and I got really angry with myself. And I went and cared and played my best Magic. So I've mentioned the words competitive anger a lot on the show. I can't really describe what it is, but there's certain things that happen that motivate me to this like extreme level. And it would have to be like 1,000 people around me saying that I'm clearly no longer good at Magic or something. I don't know. It's something that there's always that, you know, I need that chip on my shoulder that I want to prove people wrong thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the one thing that drives me, as I mentioned last episode, is always to represent my country. So I will still have that insane drive once WMC Q season rolls around. So that's something that's going to happen for sure. And watching the MDSS that happen and seeing a lot of plays that, you know, I would have made differently than some other players, that certainly also motivates me to come back. It's like, I want to be sitting in that seat making those moves that I think are better, right? So mm-hmm. So there's always that also motivates me, seeing things that I could do better. So
so let's talk about your transition a little bit.
Sure.
From being, because you were kind of a corporate IT guy, right? Previous to this?
You could say that.
And then that job, I hear, comes with a pretty nice salary and a lot of stability and is probably pays you way more. What inspired you to make that transition from doing that to working at Face to Face with Magic full time? And also, how is your fiance kind of like, what's her kind of take on it?
My potential fiance.
What's up? Come on, man. Okay. Come on.
She's been supportive, but basically I made a decision because in terms of a job security level, what I learned throughout my years in IT and having my dad be in the IT world, in the tech world, like he's an electrical engineer. He's been laid off at a company that he was at a high position in. I was a programmer for Nokia, which is, you know, at the time, or Nokia, everyone pronounces it differently, which at one point was the biggest phone company in the world. And they just did not have a smartphone game plan. And if they did, it would still exist and not have been bought out by Microsoft, but they were number one in the world. Everyone had one, and then they just died off. And so I sort of lost my job when Nokia sort of transitioned into a phase. So from a job security standpoint, it really comes to whether Magic will still be as awesome as it is now. I mean, it's been growing at a ridiculous rate, and everyone's expecting the bubble to burst. And I think you mentioned maybe we're starting to see it like slow down a bit, but it hasn't like popped the bubble. We're seeing like the next year GP schedule is crazy. But then there's the fact that I'm being put in a spot, for once I'm being hired in a spot that's like specifically designed for me, and a position that they had only envisioned having me in. So that's the type of, you know, it's a weird, it's a different type of job security, right? It's like, it makes me feel like, you know, they're looking as me as part of their long-term plan. So it's not like something that's totally different from when I was just one of the drones at Nokia. Like, they could just kick me out and replace me with someone else. So what I love about it is just the value that I bring, and the value that I feel that I can feel that I bring, which is really important. Being the one guy who wrote a couple of lines of code in a, among a thousands lines of codes or million lines of code in a product, is not like super satisfying, right? Like, people will love it, but they have no clue you were a big part of it. This is different. And of course, a lot of flexibilities in terms of schedule, which Cedric could previously attest to, and Frank Lepore. Like, they both, before Frank, before Cedric moved to Roanoke to be like the ultimate SCG guy, I think he's replacing Evan Irwin's old slot, I feel. Both him and Frank, who is the editor for TCGplayer.com, they worked remotely
Seattle.
So I'm the sort of the same thing. I mean, they would love to see me in the office, but a lot of the things that I'm responsible for, I could just do at home. And they're pretty flexible when I come in and leave, as long as I'm, you know, I'm not coming in for 2 hours or something stupid. So there's a lot of these like non-monetary things that this job has that I love. And of course, it deals with something that I am passionate about. Maybe not competitively anymore, but Magic is still a very huge part of my life. So that made the transition very easy.
Okay. And what does your family think about this? Because you come from a fairly traditional... Now, I realize that Asian American and Asian Canadian are different.
Right.
I'm assuming they share some of the same values, because, you know, you guys, you know, Asian Americans and Asian Canadians both share Asian roots. What do they kind of think about this?
I mean, they were obviously, it was a struggle. Now you're making me think about our very first interview together when we first met, because I talked about the struggle, because they would much rather have, all of these Asian parents would rather have their son be able to play an instrument instead of, like, they probably rated instrument number one, maybe playing chess number two, and like Magic at a distant third. And it's like, well, Magic and chess are basically the same thing. And I mean, sure, playing instrument is sort of, it can prove to be useful in some amount of scenarios, like showing off to other family, or being able to play at a talent show, or impressing a girlfriend, a future girlfriend, or something like that. But it's still like a display. It's a hobby where it takes skill. To me, it's not so different. Now, one of them does not make you more intellectual than another, right? And when it comes to jobs, it's the same thing. They just want a stable job. And the problem is, the world has evolved so much. Like, there's just so much freelance opportunity via the online world that is just so alien to how, like, my mom was brought up. I think my dad might be more accepting of this new world. And I mean, stores like Star City Games, like, I wonder how much money they make. They're like an actual, I mean, sure, it's just a card store. Like, to my mom, it would probably be like, what? Like, so, but I'm like, look, I work for Nokia. It didn't even last. So who's to say that, like, these other markets? And then you're always seeing, as you grow up, you sort of see a lot of these companies fold because of technology. I mean, Blockbuster used to be something before. And due to technology, things change. And yeah. I'm hoping my, you know, I think it's still an ongoing process, but I think they're beginning to accept it. But of course, it was really hard at the beginning because it's just so, they come from something that's just super traditional. And I think the internet just, you know, changed a lot of things that made things a lot different now. So, but it's hard. It will always be hard. And even now, it's just like, if I were a master guitarist or a piano player, I think my mom would be more proud of me.
Yeah.
Than to have like one of the most popular magic podcasts around, which itself is, as a guy who was like super shy in elementary school and high school, and even in real life now, I'm pretty damn shy compared to a lot of people. I don't actively approach listeners or anything like that. So, you know, that's something I like this podcast, I'm extremely proud about, but it's not, doesn't follow the same category as some of these other things. So, mm-hmm.
So two goals, let's just plan out two goals for 2016. What would you say that they are? So the WMC is WMCQ. Is that a representing Canada? Is that a goal for 2016?
It's a goal, but it's not a reasonable goal because I'm not gonna compete for the top slot. It's probably gonna be Alex or some other full time player like Sean McLaren or Alex or whoever decides to play full time. Or it could be Ricky Chin, because he's got a head start being, I think he finished second in the first PT of the season, right? Or something. So, no, he didn't finish second. He finished in the top four because the finals was an all-Japanese final.
Yeah.
So, he's got like some sort of head start. And Alex has a head start from being in the Players' Championship, etc. So having that slot is not really realistic. And winning one of the three tournaments, one of them being in Vancouver or in the West, which I'm probably not even going to fly to because it's going to cost $700 to fly to a WMCQ. Uh-huh. Means I only have two realistic shots to make it. Not realistic.
Okay.
A realistic goal for 2016, I will try my best. Making it back to the Pro Tour, I think that is one of my goals. Once we get through this GP preparation madness, like in term not competing, but setting up GP Toronto, our very first GP from face-to-face games, after going through the stress of that, and I'll be more relaxed. So I'll be making it back to the PT. And my second goal, man, this is tough. I think it's more likely that I top eight a GP than it's tough.
Well, it could be tangentially magic related. Like if you have a goal for face to face, or if you have a you've talked a little bit about some of your duties at face to face, but you haven't really talked about like in your relationship with the big picture. So if you have like a goal for what you want to do with face to face that, you know, can get listeners excited, you know, hell, lay it on me.
Well, eventually, this is an eventuality, face-to-facegames.com will be the home of everything. I mean, Manaprive will phase out, and whether we keep the name for any other purpose, I don't know yet. But we'll phase out, and hopefully when it does make that full transition, my goal, if this will happen in 2016, I don't see why it wouldn't. Crazy would have to happen for it not to finally make that full transition. Hopefully we will have a site to sort of compete with the big boys. And, you know, now we've just got like a really cool podcast network with a lot of contributors, but hopefully once we make that transition, we'll have some of the bigger names in Canadian Magic writing and doing videos and being like some of the other sites. So from a content production standpoint, getting face-to-face games to the next level in terms of content, which they absolutely have zero of right now, would be a huge goal of mine.
Okay.
And making it back to the Pro Tour from a player's standpoint would be, I guess, the second goal. And if I could bring myself back to writing a weekly column, that would be another extra third goal I would like. But that is always an extremely hard challenge.
Yeah.
As you would know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a lot. I talked a lot, my man.
Yeah, you did.
You got a lot out of me, as usual.
I got that KY touch.
I mean, so what about you? Are we going to go another half hour here?
Oh, I could probably sum up mine in a little bit more. I mean, see, here's the thing with you, KYT, is that you have, you know, you're just, at this point, you're equaling out, you know, the amount of silence that you previously had.
Oh, right, right.
You're trying to get to a nice average of talk time. So your podcasting career, you're actually going to be on par with, you know, with Scotty and with Jay and with Jeremy, but you're just going to get it in a different way. But no, my 2015 was good for me. In a lot of ways for me, it was a year of balance, of just kind of figuring out balance in my life. In terms of Magic, I worked a lot of GPs. I went to a lot of different places. I top 64'd. I not only day two'd my first GP, I cashed it, which was awesome. Which at the time when I made top 64, I didn't even know how much cash I was winning. I just was like excited to have finished, not scrubbing out. So
nice.
That was good. I think, I don't know, it was just more balance, more figuring out where Magic kind of fit in my life as a whole. And I think I'm starting to achieve that that level of self-knowledge more and more. And as well as like what other stuff I want to do. I mean, because I started, you know, I've actually been writing daily, which is really cool. Writing screenplays, which is what I want to eventually accomplish as one of my careers. I've been studying film more, reading more. Being more balanced. It's been really great.
That's awesome. That is really sweet.
So yeah, 2015. It's been a good year. Personally, I moved in with my fiance, which was great. And we started our life together, which is awesome. And so next year, so my, you know, looking forward to 2016. In terms of Magic, I definitely want to make it a goal to get on the PT. Now, whether or not I do well at the PT is another thing. That'll be a bridge I'll cross when I cross this bridge.
I'll help you cross that bridge.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. So, but getting that first, I don't know, just top 64ing Madison, just getting that taste. And also getting a feature match is one thing I would like to get in 2016. I have always been the one, I've facilitated, I don't know how many feature matches, both in the store that I ran and in tournaments that I've covered, and then in major tournaments that I've covered, but I've never actually gotten to sit in the seat of a feature match player, and I want to. So that's a goal for me for 2016. So,
like any event, right? At a GP or a PT or whatever.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah. Large event, preferably.
Man, I was so embarrassed when they featured me. When my draft went off the rails and they featured me against Huey Jensen in GP Ottawa, because, of course, I'm Captain Canada, so they have to feature me. And then they featured me against a Hall of Famer, so it's like the perfect time to feature me. But my deck was awful. And so I'm very embarrassed about that. And other times that I've been featured, I think I was always like the second match. I did get text coverage against Shuhei Nakamura, because Josh Bennett likes me. He's usually the coverage writer, and it was GP Montreal, and again, it was against a Hall of Famer, and it was me in my hometown, so they had a good excuse to get me some coverage. So I've had a taste, but against Huey, I still remember that. That still was super embarrassing. So I'm happy to hear about those goals, and I'm excited to be part of some of the process, I think, especially when it comes to making it to your first Pro Tour.
Yeah. And also, holy crap, to talk about how full 2015 was. So it was, to think about it, it was only June, because Modern Masters GP was this year, right? I'm not crazy.
I don't think you're crazy, no.
Yeah. So, a little bit about my Japan trip, which was the first time I got to fly over an ocean. That was insane. I got to work with doing my job with like Japanese translators and listening to matches of Magic, where out of the 15, you know, out of the 18 rounds, only one of them spoke English. There was only one English feature match that I got to witness, and it was only because there was a guy, an American who was stationed in Japan, was playing against somebody else who also spoke English. So, and then I got to hear a little bit because there was a guy from Singapore who was speaking to a judge. So yeah, that was pretty incredible. So getting to learn like the culture of how another country plays Magic, like how another culture plays Magic. And then in Japan, I asked my fiance to marry me. So, which is pretty storybook.
Sick.
Yeah. So, you know, rooftop of our hotel in Tokyo, which is like crazy that Magic has allowed me to do that. Like I live such a weird life, like KYT. We live such weird lives. Like, this is crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that.
But, and who'd have thought, you know, 18 years ago when I was just marveling at two dudes in my local game store tapping these lands and adding this mana stuff to their mana pool. What is that? What is the mana pool? And then they were just tapping cards and saying words to each other. Like 18 years ago, that was me. And then, you know, to think about it now, it's just crazy.
I agree with you. And yeah, I guess that will do it for our show.
Yeah. Oh, contest time.
Oh yeah, contest time.
So we did a riddle last week.
I keep forgetting this.
Yeah.
You keep like making me feel sloppy when you do this.
Well, I'm making you feel sloppy. You know, maybe if you weren't, you know, maybe you shouldn't be sloppy.
Oh, got me there.
I have show notes written down right here. I have notes.
Oh, you got me.
So we did a riddle last week. We got 10 comments actually, which is pretty sweet. Not to mention the replies to comments and things like that. And as well as Max Roche just chiming in to say hi. So I did a riddle. The riddle, if for those that have forgotten, it is, I'm a one and oldie, but I'm not black or goldie, and I'm coldie. Never rapping, always tapping, for little mana, I stop attacking. What am I? KYT, did you guess?
I had no idea.
It was Icy Manipulator.
Ooh, some people were right.
Yeah, so 6 people got it right, and 4 people did not. So, but I'm going to kind of just go through the riddle. I'm a one. So that ties into the fact that it is a mono artifact. Back when in Alpha, when they printed mono and continuous artifacts, which I don't, KYT, do you remember that?
No, I do not.
Yeah, they were just different. I believe how it separated was that if your artifact had an activated ability, it was a mono artifact. but if it had a continuous ability like Winter Orb, it was a continuous artifact. So that was the difference there. And Oldie, so the card is from Alpha, was originally printed in Alpha. It has been reprinted 10 times since then, including its online printings. But I'm not black or Goldie. That alludes to the fact that it is an uncommon, and it has almost, I think, always been an uncommon. So it is not black, common, or Goldie, rare. And I'm Coldie, icy, blah, blah, blah. So never wrapping was a red herring because it makes no sense, because except that it rhymes with always tapping, because Winter Icy Manipulator always taps. And then for little mana, one mana, I stop attacking. It stopped your creature from attacking. So that was the kind of, that was the riddle. And so what I'm going to do is, since six people got it right, I'm going to roll a D6. And from among those six people, we are going to pick a winner of the play of the, of a random GP playmat. And then from the four people who didn't get it correct, I'm going to roll and send them something that I can send in a regularly stamped envelope. So the six people who got it right, give yourselves a round of applause for being so clever, or copying off those who are cleverer than you. Kevin McShay, Paul Whitcomb, Michael Tien, Lord Frezen, Drago, and Mike Dubs. So I'm going to roll the six, and we'll figure out who wins the playmat. Looks like Drago. Drago, you have won the playmat. Send your mailing address to the email address that KYT will give you after I choose the winner of the smaller prize out of Dan L., AJ Anderson, Mandrew, and Bruce Richard. You guys, you had some good guesses. I liked Gela Shackles. That was pretty cool. But here we go. And Bruce Richard, you win the smaller prize. So Bruce Richard and Drago, send your information to KYT.
Oh man, wait, I have to correct you, because he's gonna, it's Bruce Richard.
Richard, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm American. Is he French Canadian?
Yeah, he's you pronounce it just like Maurice the Rocket Richard.
Okay.
Famous hockey player. Yeah. Well, he's not. He doesn't live in Canada anymore. I think he lives. He works all the way in Boston.
Oh, okay. So he's Bruce Richard now.
Yeah, I guess he is. Sorry, Bruce. But yeah, send me an email at kyt@manadeprive.com. And for you, Bruce, you have multiple options to contact me. You can DM me or whatever, because I know you. So
yeah, and then Drago, also send your information. To get the playmat.
Man, that's awesome, because that means they got through the 2015-16 goals part of me blabbing. So
right?
That's awesome.
Right? So you spent 30 minutes on yours. I spent upwards of like 2.5, I think.
Yeah, but you kept asking these deep questions. Like, what does your parents think? Your Asian parents, you know? It's it brings back all these memories.
And then so, this will be the last contest for 2015. I pulled another one off my shelf, and this one I'm gonna leave for 3 weeks because it's a good one for some more creative responses. Now it's different in that I don't have a card in mind. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a fortune from the fortune cookie that I got from the really bad Chinese buffet I had earlier this week. And what I want you to do is comment with a card you think fits the fortune and say a little bit about why you've picked that particular card to go with this particular fortune. Now, I'm not going to roll for this one. For this contest, you have to impress me. So I'm going to be completely, it's going to be completely subjective as opposed to the objective roll that I usually make. So the fortune, which is a bad one from a bad Chinese buffet. It is much wiser to take advice than to give it. And so, yeah, comment with a card you feel matches that fortune.
Well, that's perfect. That's perfect.
All right.
I guess finally this is the end of the show. Is there anything I've sloppily forgotten again?
Did you want to talk about your childhood?
No. Okay. So see you guys in 2016. Thank you for all the support after all these years. We will be coming on strong in 2016. Hashtag more Mendoza if you want to keep him for the next year. So make sure to keep hashtagging that. And we'll see you in the new year, guys. Bye.
Bye.